It's the fifth day of November. A very good afternoon to you and welcome to the MoneyWeb at Midday Show. I'm Duduzile Ramela standing in for Jeremy Mags this afternoon. And over the next 30 minutes, we'll bring you the latest headlines from South Africa and around the globe. Whether you're tuning in live or catching the podcast later on, stay with us for in-depth conversations with leading business minds, political influencers and key newsmakers. It's everything you need to know to stay informed. Quick, sharp, and straight to the point. Here's what you can look forward to in the show today. So it's the 5th of November, which means that Americans are heading to the polls today. It's the day in which a number of people have been looking forward to. We're going to be speaking in a few moments with Brooks Spector. He's a political commentator in terms of what to expect for the polls. And we also explore why an expert says a crime prevention program is not working, more so when it comes to amapanyaza. Hype, hope and hopelessness as South Africa is faced with some tough decisions post the BRICS summit. That's the assertion of Professor Patrick Bond. He's going to be telling us why he believes that it's just hype, hope and hopelessness. And then we're going to take a look at smart spending strategies to avoid a debt trap this coming holiday season. All that and more in a few moments.
MoneyWeb at Midday for all your up-to-date stories.
So after numerous live debates, election rallies, celebrity endorsements, and the dishing out of millions of dollars to swing voters, the U.S. election day is upon us. After all is said and done, who will become victorious between Donald Trump and Kamala Harris? More importantly, why should people on the African continent care about this? What is the United States' position or policy position when it comes to the continent of Africa? And whoever wins, we'll have to take that forward or even take a new look at it, right? So let's speak more on this with Brooks Spector, political commentator, in terms of what to expect. Brooks, thank you very much for your time this afternoon. Firstly, I'd like for us to start with this acronym, right? USA. Why is it called the United States of America?
Well, it's united as opposed to divided, although I think you could argue that politically now it's rather divided. Right. States as opposed to colonies, because that's what they were before independence, and America because the continent, north and south, is named after an Italian navigator, Amerigo Vespucci, back in 15-something or other, even though it's not clear he ever traveled to America. Mapmakers gave him the name, and gave the continents his name, and it's stuck ever since. And there we end up. And I guess Canadians get a little bit upset every once in a while when you say you're an American. They say, "Wait a minute, we're from North America too." But the name has largely stuck, and there we are.
Right, and you take a look at these 50 states, if I'm not mistaken. Right, what idea of Donald Trump versus Kamala Harris? As you mentioned, at the moment, it might not be so united. Where do you see this going after all is said and done? I guess that's what people really want to know. Who's going to come out tops?
Oh, sure. Everybody wants to know the answer. Partly, I guess people with an itch to bet, they're really interested to know. People who have to deal with it politically, they really want to know. And the average person wants to know because it's newsworthy. We have to know these things. Mm-hmm. And if you're a South African, you have, despite what you might think, you have a vested interest in a number of different directions as to who comes out ahead. Mm-hmm. Now, as far as money being spent, it's more than millions. It's rather several billions of dollars, which is certainly quite impressive. But when you think about it, the costs of electronics, the cost of travel, the cost of staff, the cost of computer time, the cost of all the things that go with that, the money runs mounts the cost mount up enormously very quickly. And so candidates are caught on a treadmill, like one of those hamster wheels, always trying to raise money to cover the cost of the campaign. And now, of course, many people have noticed there are something called political action committees, which technically aren't supporting a particular candidate, rather as opposed to supporting an issue or an idea. But sometimes that thin line between the two gets really, really wavy, as we have noticed with Elon Musk's contributions to the affair.
Right.
But if you, you know, if it's worth comparing, despite Kamala Harris's late start as a candidate, she actually raised more money by a significant amount than Donald Trump did. And much of it came from small contributions by individuals, under the $200 range. Now, $200 as a campaign contribution is much lower than the legal limit for a person, which is, I think, $2,800 per person. So these are small contributions people make pretty willingly with the click of a mouse nowadays on a computer.
When we take a look at, right, because you mentioned vested interest, right, as South Africans, whether you are, whether you know it or not, you've got a vested interest in what happens in the United States of America. Donald Trump, when he was president, he once referred to African countries as, we will not say the word, but SH countries. And so what do you perceive, if anything at all, will be different this time around if he does come out tops?
Okay, first of all, we don't know he's going to win. Right now, the official vote total is, are you ready for this, 3-3, because a small village way up in the north of New Hampshire gets together in somebody's living room at midnight, and they vote, and then it's recorded. So right now, three votes for Trump, three votes for Harris, and it'll stay that way for another X number of hours till the actual numbers come in. But to the heart of your question, Donald Trump's foreign policy and foreign economic policies generally are what we call transactional. You do something for me, and I'll do something for you. There's no altruism or unilateral, I think it's a good thing to do because it's better for us that we do it. And specifically, think of AGOA, the African Growth and Opportunity Act, which is not a treaty, it's U.S. law. And that expires, in fact, next year, and it gives preferential duty-free access to the American market, which is pretty big for products produced in Africa. And South Africa has actually done very well by it. And depending on who you talk to and how it's measured, somewhere between 75 and 100,000 workers are directly dependent on companies and processes that produce products that end up in the U.S. And these include things from automobiles to automobiles, car seats to high-end processed agricultural products. And here we're thinking of the liquid variety, wine, which get a duty-free pass into the U.S. Now, I mean, the duty is not enormous, but if Donald Trump has his way, all duties, all products imported into the U.S. would all be subject to a tariff, and depending on what day he's asked the question, 10%, 50%, 100%, I've heard all these numbers up to 200%. If it was 200%, it's going to collapse an awful lot of foreign exporters to the United States. They won't bother. It will also produce inflation in the U.S. All right, what else is at stake? The PEPFAR program, which also comes up for renewal. PEPFAR, of course, has been supporting all manner of efforts to deal with HIV and AIDS. Again, it's a unilateral program. There's no treaty involved, and so it's subject to the decision of the U.S. government to continue it or not. Okay. And then there are things like Power Africa and the other one, Energy Africa, and support even for the Lobito Corridor rail redevelopment that goes from Zambia to Lobito on the Atlantic coast of Angola. Now, all those, they won't be cut off immediately, and I'm not arguing that, but the pressure will be to look for much more stringent transactional responses under a Trump regime. Harris, I think, by contrast, we can say, will follow the more traditional route of these kinds of programs that, after all, have had strong bipartisan support since their inception.
Yeah, because I wanted to ask then when we compare, or rather, not even compare, but when we take a look at Kamala Harris, what to expect? Because she's been on the continent a number of times. So what you've described, it sounds like with Donald Trump, what you see is what you get. The kind of what person that Kamala Harris is, but also guided, obviously, by policy and her party, etc., a direction, what to expect from her.
Well, I would also add, I should have mentioned this right at, in that litany of things that I already did, and that, of course, is global climate support for dealing with global climate and related issues. And Donald Trump has famously referred to the global climate crisis as a hoax, and the green hoax in terms of programs that are supposed to support renewable or alternative energy projects. That's something that you will find a sharp difference between Donald Trump and Kamala Harris on. And I would expect that if she were to win, there will be renewed emphasis on trying to be a leader in those areas rather than a very reluctant participant in the Trump administration. Were that to come.
Thank you so much, Brooks, for your time and your contribution this afternoon. Brooks Spector is a political commentator.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
I do beg your pardon. A little bit enthusiastic there to get into the conversation with Professor Patrick Bond. So please do stay with us. We're going to speak to Professor Patrick Bond in a few moments. For now, let's take a look, let's take a listen to Jeremy Maggs in a conversation with Gareth Newman, head of Justice and Violence Prevention Program at the Institute for Security Studies, on whether the crime prevention program of Amapanyaza is truly working for South Africa.
Well, this boots on the ground strategy has long been practiced in policing going back to the 1960s or before that. When people are feeling scared, when they feel that crime is out of control, they want to see police in action. So there's generally a community demand for more policing. We want to see police officers doing roadblocks, searching people. It makes us feel that the police are then getting on top of things. So that's what people call for. And the police are happy to respond because it's a very easy thing to do. You marshal all your boots, your personnel, your vehicles into a specific area where people are feeling unsafe, and you do your roadblocks, search and seizures, and so forth. However, the evidence from the 1970s shows that this is not a sustainable way of reducing crime. For a limited period of time, usually for the time that the police are busy, crime does drop. So if they're there for a week or a month, crime will go down while the police are doing these high visibility operations. However, as soon as they leave, crime goes back to its normal or previous levels because they haven't addressed the factors that cause crime in the first place. So this is why we see this kind of thing. And it's a very favored tactic in South Africa, going back to Operation Crackdown, which was launched in April 2000, Operation Fiela through the mid-2000s, Operation Okaima Lao since 2019 in Gauteng, and then Operation Shanela since May last year. It's favored by politicians because they can then show to the public that they're taking crime problems seriously, and it also generates great statistics. 700,000 arrests, thousands of kilograms of marijuana seized, fake goods seized. So it makes people feel that the police are working, and that's why. However, it doesn't reduce crime in any sustainable way. And unfortunately, rather than understanding that having highly effective law enforcement agencies that target their resources against the very specific individuals, groups, and networks that cause the most harm, making sure they're disrupted, those people go to jail. They tend to do these large-scale operations, which means we need lots of boots, so we go for large numbers of lowly skilled people. So rather than saying if we have the rule of law and effective safety, we'll see the economy grow and unemployment drop, our government seems to think we can use law enforcement as a way to solve the unemployment problem. That's why the police are on a mass recruitment drive at the moment to hire 30,000 new constables by the end of next year. However, these are very lowly skilled people. They have very limited capabilities to learn the complexities of policing and intelligence-driven policing approaches that are effective. So until we change our policing model in South Africa, we're not going to see much improvement in our public safety, regardless of how many thousands of people we hire into the SAPs or how many crime wardens we hire.
Let's talk about that recalibrated model in just a moment. But is it not also about finding some degree of balance? People do take solace from seeing uniforms on the streets.
Well, it depends who you ask. If you ask most young black men in townships and informal settlements, I don't think they'll tell you they see much solace seeing uniformed men on the streets. if you ask many women in informal townships, poor women in certain suburbs and townships, they also will tell you that they don't feel much solace from men in uniforms because there's a huge problem with sexual harassment, huge problem with corruption. And so, you know, one in four South Africans in representative surveys say they have any trust in the police. So it's a bit of a fallacy that just seeing the police in South Africa makes people feel safe. People do want police, but they want good police. They want police women and men who treat them with dignity, who uphold their rights, and are able to provide them with service. And that is not the policing we have in South Africa.
So what's a better model then?
A better model is to have a smaller, much more capable, highly skilled police orientation or service where we ensure that the people in the police organization have the right characteristics. They've been selected because they are able to communicate very well to different audiences. They have the ability to solve problems, think innovatively, work in teams, and they're able to mobilize communities. Those are different skill sets to what we use. We use about 18 criteria to hire constables. Most of these are physical criteria, your height, your weight, your age, your fitness levels. We expect you to have a trick, and that's it. And they used to have driver's licenses as a criteria, and that was dropped. So we go for the large mass recruitment, low-skilled model because we think that if there's more police, we'll have less crime. And that has also been proven to be a fallacy. Mm. Also going back, you know, since the 1960s, there's no evidence whatsoever anywhere in the world that more police automatically reduces crime. What the police do and their capabilities are the key factors to how you reduce crime with policing.
And to that point, Gareth, what skills then are germane to this debate that we need to either upweight or are lacking in their entirety?
Well, we need police officers to be able to make independent decisions in complex situations. They must be very familiar with the law and the regulations, the code of ethics and conduct that govern them. They must be very familiar not only with them on paper and theory, but in practice. In other words, when they're being trained, they must be able to apply these principles, apply these regulations and laws in complex situations. They must be able to communicate, assimilate information, assess what's going on, make a decision that's within the bounds expected from them and standards expected from them. And those are not easy skills to have. You need people who've often had some kind of tertiary education or some post-matric education. You need people who are passionate about solving problems. People who are passionate in serving their communities, have a strong civic ethos, and are willing and able to learn new skills, because the reality is, in most police agencies, it is a lifelong career, and the crime situation and the technology situation changes over the career. So you need to have people who can learn new skills as they progress in their career. When you hire large numbers of people who are very lowly skilled, you find that a large proportion of them have a limit on what they can learn, and then you're stuck with large numbers of people who are left behind as technology and crime patterns shift and change and become more complex.
Gareth Newham, thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
All right, now we can speak to Professor Patrick Bond, who has written an opinion piece suggesting that the recently concluded 2024 BRICS summit in Kazan, Russia, was nothing but an exercise in hype, hope, and hopelessness. In an opinion piece published by IOL, Professor Bond argues that the upcoming COP29 climate conference will be the most interesting conference in history. Of course, BRICS is going to be part of that conference. He joins us now to tell us why. Prof, thank you very much for your time this afternoon. Let's take a look at what you argue in your opinion piece about the economic imbalances right within BRICS. You also are of the belief that South Africa has missed critical openings in BRICS to enhance trade and infrastructure, citing that a number of projects or deals we entered into since last year's conference have actually not even materialized.
Yes, I'm so happy to join you and the listeners do. And one other big event, which is the 18th, 19th of November, is the G20. Mm. That's in Rio de Janeiro. And we host probably September in Johannesburg, 2025, the same body. And it's this very interesting mix, isn't it, where the BRICS Plus have come up. Now there are 9, but maybe 10. It's not just Brazil, Russia, India, China, yeah, South Africa, but it's also, as of January 1, Iran, but also UAE, an enemy, and maybe Saudi Arabia, they're in and out. And it's Egypt and Ethiopia. So we have 5 new members. One additional, Argentina, had been invited in Johannesburg last year, but then there was a right-wing government that walked away from that invitation. But then Azerbaijan, which is a place that Vladimir Putin influenced the choice of to host the next big climate summit is like the last two, which were in Dubai, and before that, Sharm el-Sheikh in Egypt. So you have another UAE and Egypt. You have the BRICS really dominating as hosts of these institutions. Next year, it'll be Brazil. It'll be which is also where BRICS will be hosted. So we're seeing a sort of shift, at least, of hosting. But then the big question is there any difference between what the BRICS Plus and the West are doing? And this is the most important issue of our time. Today's probably the most important day. If Donald Trump gets elected, as polls suggest, then we can throw all these questions into the air and try to answer them in a different way, because it'll mean the U.S. pulls out of the United Nations Climate Summit. It means that probably AGOA will be cut very quickly because Trump is so pro-Israel and South Africa takes a stance against genocide in the International Court of Justice. So we know Republicans don't want to continue with any appearance of being generous to South Africa under those circumstances. And then we'll also see a G20, which will be utterly chaotic because we have a free market-oriented China going to the WTO to try to expand its powers, but the protectionist West, not just the US, but also Europe, it all seems in terrible flux. And the biggest problems of all, such as you say, Azerbaijan, the climate crisis, or the deglobalization and worsening inequality and financial volatility on the economic front, plus the geopolitical conflicts, Israel and genociding Palestine, and Russia destroying so many people, 600,000 Ukrainians and infrastructure. It's an extraordinary time, and we have such fluid international politics, don't we?
We have such fluid international politics. I would like for us to explore the role of South Africa, right? More so when we speak of the recently concluded summit and we take a look at what to expect at COP. You suggest rather that South Africa seemed lost and out in the woods when the issue of global energy sovereignty, energy security and cooperation were discussed. Help us understand this with the narrative or what we are being told here at home about the just energy transition. All of these agreements that we're entering into, right, when it comes to renewable energy, etc. So if we are on an international stage and we seem out of our depth, what then should we make of it?
I think I would make of it that the interests of the big powerful forces in our economy, which are fossil addicted without any doubt, right? The energy intensive users group of 27 companies, they use 42% of our electricity, they provide 4% of our jobs. So it's a very carbon intensive and capital intensive group, and they don't really want any change. So in the big picture, South Africa and the BRICS, which have 51% of all global emissions with just 29% of GDP, including all 10, Saudi Arabia too, they have the same interests as the West. It's simply 3 points. Number one, don't make the emissions cuts that I think the rest of the world, the scientists are saying, you have to make these emissions cuts. Otherwise, it's planetary arson. Number two, don't ever admit that you made emissions. Don't do a polluter pays. You know, to do if you're a company and you pollute, then the National Environmental Management Act says, hey, well, you have a liability, clean it up. But that doesn't apply for greenhouse gas emissions, and that's partly because the U.S. itself in 2009, Barack Obama did a deal with Jacob Zuma and Lula, Wen Jiabao from China, Manmohan Singh from India. That was the famous room in the Copenhagen Convention Center that Obama barged into and said, let's do a deal. And part of that deal, which was codified in 2015 in the Paris Climate Agreement, no liability. Nobody ever emitted. So the loss and damage, like the Durban rain bomb that killed 500 or the flooding in Kabeja and Cape Town that was so destructive, it never happened, or nobody did it. It's just an accident. That is a crucial point, right? Because it means the people who did the damage get away with it. And the third is, let's privatize the air. And that point, which is the carbon markets, emissions trading and offsets, all the sort of ideas that if you sell the right to pollute, and then you can find some project in the south to sequester emissions, to suck up the carbon you're doing in the north. Well, the BRICS and South Africa are part of that as well. And it's not working. The European Union has the most advanced of these, and that's called the European Union Emissions Trading Scheme. Just to give you a sense of it, Dudu, it cost about 110 euros a ton to buy the right to pollute of CO2 in February 2023. But then a year later, it was down to 55, and now it's 70. So it's like asking bankers, running these markets to solve the problem, the climate catastrophe. They can't even solve their own problem. So it's a ridiculous strategy. Fortunately, South Africa is built in to the BRICS and to the West and against all the rest of us, I would say.
Because, Prof, one of the declarations on energy following the summit is highlighting the need for enhanced cooperation among BRICS nations as key energy producers and consumers. And so if we are now going to the summit and we have to either stick to what we have bound ourselves to when it comes to BRICS or aligning with what Western nations are saying, where do you see this going? Or rather, how should we even understand that? Can we really afford this one foot in, one foot out? We're not really sure what to do kind of posture, even unwittingly.
Yes, no, it's a classic, isn't it? It's talk left, walk right. The talk left is always to say we care about the climate catastrophe. We know South Africa's got a very coal-intensive economy. Maybe we should switch to methane gas. People point out, well, that's 85 times worse as a potent greenhouse gas when it leaks. We know we have lots of leaks. Look at Bree Street, for example. So we have a big problem with our credibility. But the question of your, you know, sort of alliance is, will there be conflicts, really, especially because South Africa has the potential to do nuclear with Russia, very dangerous, very high risk. We know that there was corruption or, let's say, lack of a transparency the last time the courts threw it out. The second big dilemma is, can South Africa survive having coal-intensive energy production? Can we switch faster? If the answer is no, then we have another interesting dilemma. This is where the main conflict with the West is. It's called carbon border adjustment mechanism import tariffs from Europe starting 2026. From the UK in early 2027. Oh, and my goodness, you know, if Trump wins today, then we can forget AGOA, the Africa Growth and Opportunity Act, probably on January 21 next year. So we're going to maybe see these opportunities to reconsider some of the high carbon intensive trade, the aluminium, the steel, the petrochems. Those will attract such high tariffs, given that our carbon tax is 38 US cents a ton. As I say, Europe's about $70 a ton now, and we don't think we're going to have a high carbon tax move so quickly to make up for that. So it does suggest there's some interesting conflicts. The protectionism of U.S. imperialism, European imperialism, is on full display, even with the Biden administration, right, with 100% import tariff on Chinese electric vehicles against Elon Musk's Tesla. Those are the sorts of quandaries. And to me, if you're standing outside this and sort of saying, don't make a deal with BRICS, don't make a deal with the West, actually work with the rest of the world to make the emissions cuts, to acknowledge a climate debt, and to be able to move to these new energy systems without the obligations of a just energy transition partnership, which is debt-based. It's not really a proper carrot because it doesn't have much grant component. Yeah. And with the CBAM, the Carbon Border Adjustment Mechanism, we'll have to work around whether we can really afford to have like the number one CO2 emissions hotspot in the world, which is Secunda, or incredibly high emissions coming from BHP Billiton for imported bauxite turned into aluminium.
Prof, and then add to all of that, right, is the government of national unity, a conversation we cannot unfortunately take further because even there, is there even certainty? But anyway, for today, we say thank you very much for your contribution, Professor Patrick Bond, Distinguished Professor of Sociology at the University of Johannesburg. Thank you.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Many South Africans are indebted, and with the December holidays coming up, some are trying to figure out, well, how can I make my money go a little bit longer, even though I do not have any savings at the moment? And if you are one of those South Africans that are asking themselves some tough questions when it comes to your money, your savings, your budget, etc., well, we're going to be speaking to Dehan Sherman, QC and Compliance Manager at My Law Legal, about some tips in order to navigate the festive season and beyond, right? Because we've also got 2025 coming up ahead. And what can we do better with our money? Dehan, thank you very much for your time this afternoon. So you argue that many South Africans are not financially prepared to tackle holiday spending. Why?
So what we've seen is that there's an increased reliance in credit card and loans during the festive season. And this, of course, is associated with Christmas and the holiday season in general. Consumers are spending more money on gifts and travel. And this has, of course, resulted in an increased reliance on loans where consumers haven't prepared in advance for the pressures that come along with the holiday and festive season. So it's more lack of preparation that leads to consumers being reliant on debt, and then they accumulate that debt over the festive season, and then they have to try and find ways and means to alleviate that debt pressure in the new year.
So you put it down to a lack of preparation. What of the statistics and the information, or the data that we have been seeing coming out to say, well, South African consumers are hard-pressed, where you find people relying on their credit cards to buy food?
So we've seen that there's an increased reliance on credit cards and loans from 27% to 32%. Over the period. And that definitely indicates that consumers are more reliant on debts and credit cards over the festive season. And then, of course, given that 42% of South African consumers, you know, feel financially worse off than they did the previous year, you can see how the festive season can have that impact, especially this year in comparison to previous years.
What's a financial detox approach?
So financial detox is basically a few exercises that a person can incorporate into their daily lifestyle in order to ensure that they pretty much prepare for the holiday season, and so that they prepare their finances for the holiday season. So we could start off, like, for example, saving up for the holiday season in advance and setting those goals. However, if you don't prepare in time, so say, for example, now it's November and you haven't prepared at all, you can still put certain key exercises in place in order to ensure that you prepare for that holiday season, such as no spend November. So that this is where you set goals to cut out any non-essential spending, and you limit eating out as well as any impulsive buying throughout the entire month. And that will allow you to at least free up some cash for the December holidays. You know, a subscription purge is another way that you can go about it. So you go through all the unnecessary subscriptions that you have, and you get rid of them at least temporarily up until the new year. And then finally, cash-only weeks. So you limit yourself to a weekly cash allowance for essentials like groceries. And this simple switch can keep spending tangible and help avoid overdoing it with credit cards.
So it sounds like you need to have some discipline and self-control.
Definitely. And that's the key to any sort of financial advice, is that I can give you the best advice on the planet, but it doesn't mean anything if you're not able to put it into practice. And to put it into practice requires self-control.
Absolutely. Thank you very much for your time this afternoon, Dion Sherman, QC and Compliance Manager at My Law Legal. Thank you so much, Dion.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
And that's it from the MoneyWeb at Midday team. If you missed any of our interviews, you can head on over to our website. That's www.moneyweb.co.za. Thank you very much for tuning in. We'll be back with you again tomorrow afternoon. Have a magic day further.